Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 11th, 1999. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Ralph Milton. Ralph's session number 99-8 is a continuation of his series entitled The Roots of Our Faith. This session is entitled The Joy of Getting Older. Let's listen in.
Now it's 10:45 and I go till 11:45, is that right?
Yes.
I've been having trouble with that. I realize that most of you are continuing from one session to another, but there always are some new people, so some of these sort of practical things we have to deal with ahead of time. The first one is these various books here that I have been churning out. You can, I guess, maybe pass them around or something. This book here, God for Beginners, is in the U.S. It is under the title of Christianity for Beginners, and it's published by the Methodist House.
Asbury.
Pardon me?
Asbury or Asbury?
No. Well, it doesn't matter, but it's called Christianity for Beginners. And this one here... No. It starts with an A. Abingdon, that's it. Abingdon, okay. And this one is published in the States by Westminster John Knox, but it has that title on it. If you are interested in these books, there is a list of them here with the ISBN numbers, which helps booksellers get them for you if they don't have them in stock. You can also phone this 800 number. Most of them are available on at Barnes & Noble and Amazon online, not necessarily in their stores, but sometimes in their stores. So anyway, that's that. Oh, the other thing is, I do an online sort of a magazine thing, which has some humor and some reflections and some stuff on the Revised Common Lectionary readings and so forth. There's no cost involved, and at the end of every one, it tells you how you can cancel the thing if you get sick and tired of my blathering. So I'll pass this around for any... Most of you will have seen this last time around, but in case you haven't, there's your opportunity. Oh, the picture on the front cover there is done by my son-in-law.
He does the t-shirts.
As are the t-shirts, yes. And speaking of t-shirts, how many of you are Lutherans? All right, then, all together now, what does this mean in English? Pardon me?
Sinful, and be forgiven with greater boldness.
Yes. Sin, you are, well, not, that's not quite it. It's, you are a sinner, therefore sin boldly. That's what this says. But you've got to take that in context. There's more to it than that. That you rely, that grace may abound. In other words, Luther is saying, hey, look, you're going to mess up. Recognize that. Don't walk on eggshells. Do what you are called to do and realize that you're going to mess up. And that's okay because there's God's grace for you when you do. It's a very profound statement. And I was just disappointed that all you Lutherans didn't know that right off the top. Oh, good. Okay. Start the tape. This story is called The Burnished Belly Button Syndrome. I suffer from a terrible affliction. It's not all that rare, and the cure is well known, but that doesn't make it any easier to deal with. The technical term for my ailment is jelly belly. If you don't catch jelly belly in its earlier stages, it degenerates into something worse, a hernia. It's men who get the normal kind of hernia most often, and that's when your insides try to get outside. It's a difficult and sensitive issue, this thing about a hernia. It usually needs medical attention, but don't go to my family doctor. See if you can find an overweight doctor with high blood pressure who understands things like hernias. My doctor is not only young and fit, but he has an interest in sports medicine. He goes climbing in the Himalayas. As a result, he simply cannot understand people with my malady and insists on prescribing outrageous and unrealistic remedies, like exercise. I like to get my exercise watching football on TV. He insists on things like walking or running or those social and moral abominations known as keep fit classes. The doctor prescribed the same thing for Ben, which I thought was a devious and unethical strategy. So what could I do? I was outflanked and outnumbered. Off with Bev to the keep fit classes twice a week. We gathered in a huge gymnasium, flabby bodies ravaged by floods of overindulgence and sloth. What an odd assortment we were, bulging and billowing through our clothing like Michelin men in sweatsuits. There wasn't a happy face in the crowd. Okay, we're having fun, calls our fitness instructor. She's a young woman so thin she probably only has one stripe on her pajamas. And the music starts. It's what my daughter calls soft rock, but it sounds not a bit soft to me. I can understand not a single word of what our instructor is yelling, but I try the best I can to imitate the pretzel twists and contortions she seems to enjoy so much. In between pieces of music, she yells, "Smile, you're having fun!" Well, you may be having fun, lady, I mutter to myself, but in the list of 100 things I consider the most funnest, this ranks 250. Then we start with the aerobics. That's the part where you puff and pant and get flushed in the face, the part which people my tender age should be careful with. Two-thirds of the way through, we stop to take our pulse to see whether we're about to expire. I can't find my pulse, so I assume I've died and gone to hell. By the end of the class, I'm feeling very unfit and suffering from an even worse affliction brought on between the friction between my wet sweatsuit and whatever part of your anatomy sticks out farthest. It's known as the 3B syndrome, the burnished belly button. Bev got the same thing, only twice as bad and higher up. What amazes me most about this is that we started those Keep Fit classes a year ago, and Bev and I are still going, twice a week, voluntarily. Actually, I wrote this several years ago, and I'm going to. I suppose it's because I'm finding exercise increasingly necessary. Having been basically healthy all my life, I'd forgotten there was a body somewhere below my head that needed a little attention now and again. The Bible speaks of the body as the temple of the soul. My temple has started to show a bit of weathering here and there. Some of the roofing has blown away and the foundation is sagging. I realize now that if I'd done a bit more preventive maintenance a few years ago, I wouldn't be having problems now with dry rot. The truth is, I'm physically lazy. I've often fantasized about what it would be like to have some nice, acceptable ailment that would keep me laid up for a week or two so I could read and watch hockey games on TV and have a wonderful, relaxing time. Something just serious enough so I wouldn't feel guilty about goofing off, but not so serious as to really bother me. Don, a friend of mine, broke his arm falling out of a tree. He enjoyed every minute of it. He even managed to skip work for a while. Then he went back. They assigned a flunky to drive his car, write his orders, and scratch his back. It was a great deal. Last time I saw Don, he was back up a tree trying to fall off. So I thought to myself as I sat in the doctor's office, maybe I get to have a broken arm like Don. You have a hernia, said the doctor. A hernia? I was counting on a broken arm. I had a hernia. Hernias are in that class of ailment which humans have because we've never completely adapted to walking upright. Like varicose veins and hemorrhoids, they afflict people with flabby stomach muscles, jelly belly. The doctor prescribed a hernia repair. It's a ripoff. You get one of those in-by-9, out-by-5 hospital routines. Nobody has a chance to send you flowers or chocolates. You don't even get a chance to read a magazine, much less a book. And the only reason I got a visit from my minister is because at that time my minister was Bev and she had to come and drive me home. Hernias are a signal. They say, take care of the old bod. My doctor tells me not to lift heavy stuff. He also tells me to stop thinking I'm somehow responsible for everything and everybody, like my grown-up kids, for instance, or the world situation. Do the things you can do about justice and the health of your community, but don't be so conceited. It's not all up to you. The doctor's comments got me wondering if there were such things as emotional and spiritual hernias. There must be, because Jesus offered a prescription. Consider the lilies. They goof off occasionally, but God looks after them. Keep your head focused on what's really at the top of the priority list. Don't lie awake at night stewing about things you can't fix. Don't fuss about tomorrow. Tomorrow will happen whether you're there to help it or not. Focus on God's priority list and you'll be just fine. Yeah, I know, that's not exactly the way you find it in the Bible. That's my own personal translation. And, said my athletic doctor, if you invest half an hour in exercise every day, you'll probably never have another hernia. He didn't specify which kind of exercise, or which kind of hernia. Okay, we're talking a little bit about aging today. And the part that I don't think you could hear very well in the announcement, I was saying that aging is God's most undervalued gift. It is a gift, folks. Aging is a gift. And we need to begin thinking about it that way. I'm sure many of you have suffered through birthdays. Like when I turned 60, Bev invited a whole bunch of people over and they gave me all kinds of great gifts and everybody laughed. Like somebody gave me a cane and somebody gave me a bottle of Geritol and stuff like that. And everybody had a hoot, you know. Now you're 60, you're over the hill, it's all downhill. It's the slow, slimy slide into senility. I mean, and I was laughing along with everybody. But Bev's sister told me a couple of weeks ago when we were visiting there that one of the great ways to remove wrinkles that apparently is being used in Hollywood is Preparation H. I've been called a lot of things, but that to verify it. But I have a face full of wrinkles. Even under the beard there are wrinkles. And it's taken me 64 and 3/4 years to get those wrinkles, and I'm darn proud of them, and I'm not going to put anything on there to take them off. Age is a gift, and I'm hoping that before you leave here today, you will see some of the stories of aging that I'm going to tell you, and you'll begin to think of it as a gift. It is a good and beautiful gift. In almost all cultures, including the Hebrew culture, age was considered as a beautiful thing. People would brag about how old they were, and the older you were, the more respected you were. And we have lost that in our culture. And by golly, we better get it back, because you and I are in a huge age cohort, you know, the group of people that, the number of people that are in the 60-plus age bracket now are greater than ever before, and it's going to get more so. And I know that that's going to put a terrible strain on our social support systems, and it's going to be very difficult, but nevertheless, that's the reality. There are one of the finest books I have read on that subject is one I recommend to you. It's by Betty Friedan. How many of you recognize the name of Betty Friedan? She was one of the early feminists. And apparently her friends threw a 65th birthday party for her. And she was madder than a wet hen because she said she had realized she was 65. Then she got to wondering what had happened to all those women she had worked with about 30 years ago, I guess it was. When she first published The Feminine Mystique and became famous and went around the country speaking to people. So she decided she was going to do a study on that. Now, Betty Friedan is a professional journalist, also a social worker and so forth. So just while she was on the way by, she stopped in at Harvard and picked up a graduate degree in gerontology. And then she began to study these sisters and what had happened to them, and discovered that she couldn't study them apart from studying the guys too, and so she included both men and women in her study, and has published a fine book called The Fountain of
Age.
Yes. But she says there are three primary things that are involved in successful aging. And one of them is a sense of community. You need to be with people frequently that you care about. Like a church, for instance, or some other organization, you have a group of people where you kind of belong. That's the first thing. You need to have at least one significant other person in your life that you care deeply about. And that person needs to be someone who is close enough that you are in regular contact. Grandchildren on the other side of the continent don't count, no matter how deeply you care about them. It needs to be a spouse or a friend or a grandchild or someone that you care deeply about and that you see often. And thirdly, you need to have a vocation. And by a vocation, she doesn't mean that you volunteer for everything, but that you are doing something that makes a contribution to the world. When you get up in the morning, you have a sense that you are making a contribution. You're not just taking up space. Can be creating beautiful quilts, as Bev does, writing dumb stories, as I do, or that kind of thing. Or working with people. And this can be there for you no matter how cranky your body is. I know of one woman who, until just about a week or so before she died, she was bedridden, but she would phone her various people and check up on them. She had a regular phoning list, and she believed in prayer, and she prayed for all of those. There is something all of us can do, no matter what our situation. So, that's my little sermon on aging. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought somebody was trying to talk. I want to read you a little thing that most of us don't think of us as aging. I don't think I feel any different than when I was 16. There's all kinds and parts of my body that don't work as well. I tell my son I can do anything he can do, only just not quite as often. But nevertheless, the only thing that works as well for me now as it did back then is my appetite. I'm still wake up hungry every morning. But every once in a while, something happens and you realize something. Bev and I were staying at Redeemer College in Hamilton just before the Christian festival. It was a beautiful day, and I was sitting on a chair out on the lawn reading. Along the sidewalk came a girl on a tricycle, about 6 years old was my guess. We smiled at each other. Then she stopped, gave me a most intense look, and asked, "Are you old?" I'm usually quite quick off the lip, but the child's question stopped me cold. And she waited. Maybe she knew she had asked a most profound question. And eventually I responded, "Yes, yes, I am." Then she said, "Will you play with me?" Were the two questions connected in her mind? They were for me. They said to me, "If you are old, I will trust you." For her, none of the bad jokes they throw at people on their birthday is just a statement of trust. "Will you play with me?" And I wanted so much to do just that, to hear more from this three-wheeled philosopher, to learn from her wisdom and to delight in her joy of life. But we live in a real world, my little friend and I, so I had to say, "I would really like to play with you. But first you need to go and talk to your mom or your dad, and if one of them comes here and tells me it's okay, then we can play." "My dad doesn't live with me anymore," she said very soberly. "I'll ask my mom." She didn't return. Perhaps she didn't need to. She had left her gift with me. She had given me a tiny transfiguration moment. She had transfigured me from a man angry at his age and his limitations and his necessities to a man delighting in his age and in the candid, open, and affirming trust of a child. Yes, little girl, I am old. Yes, yes, and I would also very much like to play with you. No, no, you don't need to do that. You can do that at the end. The gift of age. A few years ago, I think it was about 3 years ago, Bev and I were asked to do the worship service in our congregation on what they call Low Sunday, the Sunday after Christmas. And in our church, at least, the attendance builds up and up and up and then hits its peak just at Christmas, and then the Sunday after Christmas, boom! The gospel reading for that Sunday was the story of Anna and Simeon. Do you remember the story in the Bible? Mary and Joseph bring the child Jesus into the temple for a blessing. This was not the circumcision thing, but they brought him in there to the temple to dedicate the child, and they are met by Anna, an old person who'd lived in the temple all her life, and by Simeon, who was also there. And it struck me as I was working on the sermon that these people were the old folks in the church. And that on that Sunday, the people who would be attending would be the Annas and the Simeons. The people who were really always there, every Sunday, rain or shine. Well, Sunday morning dawned, and we looked out the window, and there was a foot of snow on the ground, at least a foot. And we thought, oh my goodness, you know, nobody's going to come. We have a four-wheel drive vehicle, so we got to church without much trouble. But as Bev and I were saying to each other as we drove there, that, there'll only be half a dozen people here. Let's just take them into the lounge and we'll just sit there and we'll talk, have a little Bible study, a few prayers and so forth, rather than having a full worship service. Well, 60 people turned up. Now, 60 people is a very small congregation there. Normally, there's a couple of hundred. But on the Sunday after Christmas, after a foot of snow, I was astounded. But you know, they were all the Annas and the Simeons. They were all the Annas and the Simeons. And they were there, except for one granddaughter of one of the people. So we talked about the Annas and the Simeons and their stalwart support and always their faithfulness in the church, just like the Anna and Simeon there. And at the end of the service, on the spur of the moment, I got them all to stand and I inducted them all into the ancient order of Anna and Simeon. And that was a very moving moment for me. Because, you see, I am convinced that one of the major things we need to do in our church right now is to free up the seniors for their ministry. I'm not talking about ministry to the old folks in the retirement homes. Most of us here will never see the inside of a retirement home except as a visitor. Most of us will hit 80 plus years, and then a heart attack or cancer or something will take us fairly quickly. But very few, the percentage who actually go into nursing homes is very small. But our church's ministry, when we think of ministry to the aging, is almost always thinking of those folks in the nursing home. Well, I'm not also talking about a ministry to people like many of you. Some of you are still teenagers, but I'm talking about the seniors here. I'm talking about the ministry of seniors. We are the wealthiest seniors in history. We are the most highly educated seniors in history. We are the healthiest seniors in history. We have more to give to other people than any group of seniors in history. Think of it, folks. Think of what would happen if you could mobilize this kind of a force. Do you remember the Grey Panthers? What was the woman's name who started that?
Maggie Kuhn.
And she kind of got a whole bunch of folks. There's the group of women in our community who are the, what do they call themselves, Bev, do you remember?
Singing Grannies?
Raging
Grannies.
Raging Grannies, yes. It's just wonderful what happens when people say, hey, I have something to give. Most seniors do retire quite well, and I think that probably saying this to you is like preaching to the converted already. But you do need to know the downside of this. One winter of a couple of years ago, a friend of ours who had a trailer in a suburb of Phoenix said we could use it for a month. So we did. We went down there. And we had a good time doing the tourist thing. No problem. But we were quite upset about the kind of lifestyle that we saw in that. Organized avoidance. It was really sad because the people there, many of them, not all, but many of them, were working so hard at avoiding and running away from the problems of aging. Running away from the possibility that they might be the next one who would get sick and die. Avoiding any attachments that they would find uncomfortable with. They spent great time sitting in the swimming pool with their hats on talking about, the women talked about their grandchildren and the men talked about sports. They all complained about politics a lot, but there was very little substantive talk at all. Great deal of alcohol abuse, great deal of it. I mean, when they invited us to a happy hour, and the happy hour started about 4, and went till about 8, and watching people, they would have 6 or 7 drinks in that period of time, which is at least 5 too many, and a great deal of abuse. And making dumb things with pipe cleaners. Really is sad. They have no sense of community either. They were complaining about this couple that had been in that trailer right across the street, and we had been such good friends. We enjoyed each other so much. We were so close, but nobody had a phone number or an address. What's wrong with that picture?
Oh, you didn't tell them that they hadn't come that year.
Oh, yeah, sorry, they hadn't come that year. Yes, thanks, Beth. They hadn't arrived. They usually came at certain time of the year, and they hadn't arrived, and nobody knew why, and nobody had a phone number or an address. But we had been so close. Okay, I want to read you some models of aging, and let's start way back when. With Sarah. You know the story of Sarah. The part I want to read about is when she is ready for the geriatric ward. She's got store teeth and she's, you know, knocking back the geritol, and she is an old crone. A crone in the best sense of the word. That term is being recaptured as a term that implies a woman of wisdom. And she has never had a baby. In Hebrew culture, you were just only half a woman if you hadn't had a child. She had had a child. She had told what was her husband's name? Abraham? Sarah, Abraham. She told Abe to go into a slave woman and have a baby by her. But she wasn't satisfied with that. And then along came 2 strange-looking men to their tent and announced to Abraham that when they came back in a year, Sarah would be nursing a baby. And Sarah is in the tent listening. And she drops her store teeth. She's laughing so hard. At first it was a cough, then a stifled gasp, then a watering of nose and eyes, a rasping, wheezing, rattling noise that might have been a full-blown case of asthma or a stroke. But it was laughter. It was laughter. From arthritic toes to gray and thinning hair, it was a laughter from despair to hope, laughter from the tomb to resurrection. The old crone pulled the tent flap tight across her toothless mouth to hide her laughter, hide it from her sniggering, impotent mate, hide the laughter from the bright-eyed strangers who came announcing new and ancient promises, a child of hope for Sarah's ancient arid womb, for Abraham's ancient arid land. But hide it from the future she could not. Sarah birthed a promise in a child named Laughter, and so proclaimed a dancing god into the ages. There are not very many images of aging women in the Bible. There are not that many images of aging men either. But there is one, and we often don't realize that because we read the first part of the book of Ezekiel and we never get much through to the end because it's full of a whole lot of stuff that is just really very confusing. But if you take the time to go through that book, you find a very interesting person. Ezekiel was a very angry priest. He was sexist even by the standards of his day. His wife had died, but he somehow couldn't mourn. He was so busy being important or something. And he had all these visions of bones and valleys of bones and whether these bones could live and so forth. You know, Ezekiel saw them, dry bones. Well, that's about all we know about Ezekiel, except that if you look at the beginning of the book and how he moves on right through to the end, you find that this very angry priest. Why is this not coming back on here, folks? There. This very angry priest at the end offers a most beautiful poem, a glorious poem. It's the poem on which that Revelation takes that tree of life image from. And I wondered how it could be possible for this cranky, angry priest to move from that kind of an anger to this beautiful, life-giving poem. Well, not being a scholar or a theologian or any of those things, I wrote me a story to explain it to myself. The venerable priest walked through the bronze heat of noon with his left eye closed. It helped a little when your head was throbbing. He rubbed the veins above his ear hard enough to hurt and knew that before the sun set to begin the Sabbath, he would have a blazing, full-blown migraine. He had them often now, almost every week, almost every Sabbath, as it turned out. Every Sabbath, the old man found himself in fetal coil of agony, lying on a mat in the darkest, coolest room of his stately house, waiting for the pounding pain to stop. Why, God, on the Sabbath, when I should be debating the Torah with the elders of Israel? His fury blazed right through his headache when he saw them. A group of women, women he knew, friends of his late wife, a small gaggle of ignorant women obviously going together for their silly worship, songs and dancing and carrying on that was insulting to Yahweh. Woe unto you, women! Thus says the Lord our God, woe to you! I have called my priests to offer sacrifice in the temple, not women just anywhere at all. It is the priests who should read the Torah, not the ignorant, not the sinners, not the women. Thus says the Lord our... The prophet's voice croaked as he pressed his hand to ease his pounding head, and the women gathered their dark shawls around their faces and hurried off. He is mad, whispered one of them beneath her breath. He cannot mourn for his dead wife, Penina, said a second woman. He loved her dearly, but on her deathbed she spoke to him of Yahweh, whom she honored in her songs and dances with us. How these ways of worship offered life and hope and breath in this alien Babylon. Now he is so angry he cannot mourn. poor man. The first woman shook her head in pity. Poor man, he does not know, he cannot see the softer side of Yahweh, that through our stories and our dances, we can sing our Yahweh's song in this strange land. Ezekiel heard none of this, of course. He was almost running now, as much running as an old man's strength and pride allow, running from the heat of the sun and the anger in his heart, anger that his wife had died in peace. She should have died confessing her apostasy, refusing to admit that she understood something that he longed to know but could not let himself admit or look for. Hearing over and over the voice of Peninnah on her deathbed asking, "My husband, can the dry bones of Israel live without new life and breath?" Each time he dismissed the memory. Women are unclean, and that is why they have such unclean visions. Ezekiel hurried to his house to search his ancient texts for reassurance. "My scroll," the priest demanded from the young disciple who opened his door. Then he threw it to the floor because his hurting head blurred all the letters. A wave of nausea sent him sprawling to his mat, where he would writhe until the sun would set tomorrow. "Why, O God, do you take away my Sabbath? Why did you take away our temple, my Torah, and my Sabbath?" As the light faded in the tiny window of the room, the disciple slowly closed the door and left him in his misery. Ezekiel, the renowned, respected, much revered prophet priest of Judah, prepared to spend another Sabbath retching, cursing, struggling to survive another migraine. As evening wrapped the hurting man in cooling darkness, he slept a little, now and then. And in and through the sleepless nights and dream-filled sleep, visions of a valley, bones, dry bones, his bones, bones of the priest, bones of Jehoiakim the king, bones, fields of bones scattered over rubbled rock and sterile sand. And then the voice pulsating through the pain, "Ezekiel, can these bones live? Prophesy to these bones. Speak the tender healing word to them, Ezekiel, that they may have breath and live." Ezekiel sat up, startled by the vision. He rubbed his eyes against the dream, trying hard not to remember the voice of God which he had heard. Yes, clearly it was God, yet clearly also he had heard Peninnah. Now the first light of morning broke into the window. A quiet knock. The young disciple came to see the aging priest. "Are you all right?" he asked. "I dreamed." The ancient priest paused and breathed deep against the pain. "I dreamed of Peninnah." And then the tears began. Slow tears at first, then followed by an earthquake shuddering his body, racking, heaving sobs that trembled through the old man's bones over and over. The young disciple stood by, anxiously, not knowing what to do or say, then found his strong young arms around the ancient body, holding, cradling, offering a tenderness he'd never felt to this old man. He offered Ezekiel a cloth to dry the tears that ran great rivers down his beard, and wondered if he really saw a hint of a smile behind the waning sobs. The old priest sat there on the floor in silence, except for now and then an aftershock of sobs. Then he gently touched the hand of the disciple. "You may go now. My pain is ended. A river of tears has washed my stagnant soul, and I will live. God has given me my Sabbath." He would not write them down until after sundown, of course, but the words began to form in Ezekiel's mind, a poem to celebrate a voice he had heard in his sobs, a vision he had seen through his tears. "An angel brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water flowing from below the threshold of a temple, below the threshold of the temple, a river that I could not cross. The angel said to me, 'The water flows toward the sea, and when it meets the sea of stagnant waters, it will make them fresh. Where the river goes, living creatures all will thrive. Everything will live where the holy river goes. On the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail. But they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. So the story of a very angry old man who had an experience and a vision and a calling. How does it feel to be old, folks?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
Well, I'm quite a bit older than you are. If you live in Iowa, the chances for me to reach 100 are very high.
Ah, okay.
Iowa has the most people who are reaching 100 or older than any place in the United States.
Okay, but talk about yourself.
It's too boring.
Too boring.
Right?
Oh dear, that's a problem.
It doesn't bother me, but it might bother you.
Are you bored?
No.
No, well then you're not boring either.
My story is boring.
No! Your story is not boring. I can guarantee it. I have published a lot of books, other people's books as well as my own. The most satisfying project I ever undertook was when I realized that my mother was beginning to fail. She was getting older. And I said, Mom, would you write your autobiography for us? And she says, oh, I couldn't do that. And I said, well, Mom, if I write you letters and ask you questions, will you write me letters back and respond to them? Tell them, give me the answers. She said, sure. Mom had always written great letters. She loved writing by hand. She used to win prizes for her handwriting. Well, so over a course of about a year, I wrote her letters and she responded, and then I put all those together in more or less chronological order, and I published this book. I made seven copies. One for myself and each of there were five sibs in our family, one for my mother and one for her only surviving sister. It was a little book like that. Mother died within 100 miles of where she was born. If you asked her what her greatest accomplishment was, she would say raising five kids. Now the thing about that book though is that has been read over and over and over by our kids and by the other grandkids, because the other ones of my siblings, they also had that hanging around. They also said the same thing. The children had a need to know those roots, the stories of how things happen. And by the standards of the world, my mother's life was not interesting. But it was of absolutely keen interest to the people that she loved the most.
Well, I have one hobby, which is reading. I read approximately 5 or 6 books a week. Mm-hmm. I'm retired.
So have you written your autobiography?
I don't intend to. People wouldn't believe it.
I believe that all of us, and Bev is going to say, when are you going to start yours? I know she's going to say that. But I believe that everybody should write their autobiography. There are two main reasons for doing this. One is that in doing so, you will begin to make sense out of your life in a way that you haven't done before. You will be able to reflect on your life and who you are, and you'll have a better sense of who you are. That's the main reason. The second reason is that the people you care about want to know about your life. They are the ones for whom you are writing this. You do not go into writing an autobiography and thinking that, you know, some big publisher, Harper & Row, is going to come and publish it for you. That's unless you are really, really, really famous, that isn't going to happen. But do it for the people you care about. Do it for the people you don't need to make 1,000 copies. If you have, like in my case, let's say I made 7 copies, There actually are more copies now because a bunch of people have photocopied it, which is fine. I'm glad. But do it for those. Do it for those people.
I prefer to read biography rather than autobiography.
Well, but nobody's going to come along and write my biography.
Nobody tries to write my biography.
Well, nobody can write it like you can yourself. Yes.
I've outlived my life expectancy by 9 years, and happily so. I think one of the most important things has been learning the art of substitution. In other words, picking up something that you, to do something new, to substitute for something you cannot do. For example, I'd love to bathe in a tub, but I graduated to a shower. And, I used to sew, used to make all the clothes I made. I find it, I hurt so bad to cut out, I had to start doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
Since I'm 60, I've written about 40, 45 devotionals that have been published.
Uh-huh.
I keep writing things autobiographical, but, too.
Okay, keep on doing those autobiographical things, yes.
I wanted to know, in your opinion, at what age you should write this, since I know...
At the exact age you are now. That's all right. You can always add more to the end of it. Which?
Is to sharpen your sense of humor if you don't have one.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. This is one of the things that happens, I believe, when you are aging well, is that you have a sense of humor, and I do not mean, as I have said many times, that you are able to tell jokes or that sort of thing, but that you can see the essential ludicrousness on your life. I have one piece that I read a while back, why there should be a special blessing for bathrooms. Because in the bathroom, after you get out of the shower or the tub, whichever, you stand there in front of... Why do they put such huge mirrors in bathrooms? Ours has one, great, you cannot not look yourself. And you're standing there, just as you are, without one plea, bare naked, and God knows what you look like that way, and God loves you anyway. And so, what do? I mean, there you are, hardly the image of a Greek god, and yet you are loved by God and by others in your life, and that body is loved by God and others in your life. And so it is really good if you can manage a chuckle over things of that sort. If you can manage a chuckle over the arthritis that keeps you from climbing these marvelous mountains. If you can manage a chuckle, because there are a whole lot of low-cal problems that the best response is laughter. Not the big problems. I mean, I'm not saying that you laugh your troubles away, but there are a whole bunch of little troubles that you can laugh away. And if you can laugh away the little troubles, you'll have some energy left for the big ones. Okay. I was telling you about the story of Anna and Simeon and how we dealt with that in our church on that one Sunday. I've always been fascinated by those two. It says very little in the Bible about them, except that they were both very old, and that Anna had lost her husband many years ago, and she took up permanent residence in the temple. But they are there for the child Jesus. There seems to me a wonderful sort of continuity that reminds me of the moment when I was sitting at my brother's bedside. My brother was the oldest in our family, I'm the youngest. I was sitting at his bedside, he was dying. My brother being the oldest, he was long gone and left home by the time I got to know him, I came along. So I didn't really get to know him except as an adult. And I found that there I had to tell him while he was in a semi-coma that I said, Randy, I love you. And he managed to respond, I love you too. And he was lying there and dying, and I'm thinking of his death, but I also have in my pocket a photograph of our first grandchild who had been born just a very short time before that. And I am holding my brother's hand, my dying brother's hand in one hand, and this photo of my grandchild in the other, and trying to sense somehow the holiness of that. This movement of from childhood through adulthood to age, and the beauty of that, and the beauty of the connections. This is all part of a marvelous plan that we should become old and live in our age and live fully in our age. So, the story of Anna and Simeon. Her legs were bowed with childhood rickets and with 84 years of life. "I walk like an old goose," she would cackle. "But in my mind, I still soar like an eagle." Sometimes Anna counted her years by the people she had survived. 5 children she had born and outlived every one of them. She'd been the midwife who brought the high priest of the temple into the world, and she now acted as his unofficial mother emeritus. "Very unofficial," Anna grins. "His Highness doesn't want it known that I blew his nose and wiped his bum when he was a tadpole. But he comes and talks to me when nobody's looking. It wouldn't do for him to be seen talking to a woman, now would it?" Anna had moved into the temple, expecting to die there soon. But death didn't come. Instead, she found a new kind of life, a life of caring and counseling and friendship to the many people who came in and out of the temple each day. Her body grew smaller, her legs bowed a little more, but her eyes were bright and gentle with wisdom and good humor. Anna's special concern was for young families. Jewish custom required a firstborn son to be brought to the temple and dedicated to God. "Those parents, they're just children, really. They're so frightened, so anxious. We've got lots of priests around here, but they're so busy being important, they don't have time for young families. So I just show them around and help them get things done." Anna's special concern was poor families, intimidated by the wealth and power of the temple, afraid of being cheated by the money changers, as they often were. Anna got them through. That was her mission, getting them through a tough time. But Anna had a secret dream. She hadn't shared it with anyone except her old friend Simeon. Anna and Simeon, like Jews everywhere, had been raised with a hope that someday God would send a Messiah, a chosen one, someone who would bring a new era of love and justice. "Do you suppose we might see God's chosen one?" old Simeon would ask. "Do you suppose it's possible?" "I live in hope, Simeon. I live in hope," said Anna. "But how will we know, Anna? How will we know?" "We'll know, Simeon," Anna said, and then she wondered why she felt so sure. It was getting late in the day. Anna's bowed legs were tired. She'd been active all day in the temple in her ministry of being there for anyone who needed her. Then she saw a frail teenage girl carrying a baby. Beside her, a man, slightly older. Anna walked over quickly as her goose-like gait could carry her. "Welcome to the temple, my children." She could see that they were hot and tired from their long walk. "Come here, into the shade of the wall. You can rest for a moment. May I see your baby?" It wasn't that the baby looked different than all the other babies brought into the temple. There was nothing unusual about the mother who held it. But there was something very different happening inside. Inside Anna was an exquisite ache, a sense of powerful weakness. "Simeon!" The name was whispered, but with such intensity, the old man who was dozing nearby woke up with a start. He hurried over to Anna. Simeon looked at the child. He saw nothing unusual. But then he looked into the fire-bright eyes of his old friend. "Anna, do you suppose?" Her eyes answered his question. Simeon began to sing an ancient song, half remembered, half made up, a song of hope and thanksgiving, a song of pain and rejoicing. Anna had no voice at that moment, but she sang along in her heart. "Dear God, now I can die in peace as you promised. I have seen your salvation, a gift to all people, a light for the Gentiles, and glory for your people Israel." Late that night, Anna wept long and quietly. She grieved and celebrated all that was and all that was yet to be, and then she slept. It was only a few days later that Anna was midwife at another kind of birth. Her old friend Simeon was dying, and she was at his side, holding his hand, helping him through it, as she had helped so many others through life's changes. "I think I can die now, Anna. I'll know very soon whether the child really is the Messiah, the chosen one. I'll know very soon." Simeon closed his eyes for the last time. "But I know already, my old friend," said Anna. "Sleep well." Anybody want to respond to any of that? You know, one of the beautiful things about stories, this is what Jan was talking about earlier. The beautiful thing about stories is that we all receive them from who we are and where we are. A story is something that, well, she used the word polyvalent. I hate words like that. I believe in good old-fashioned four-letter Anglo-Saxon words. And there's a lot of really beautiful four-letter Anglo-Saxon words. What she's saying is that there's many levels of meaning. Have you ever read stories over and over again to a small child? Yes, exactly. The wheels on the bus go round and round, round. Our granddaughter just couldn't get enough of that one. And you just get to the end and she would say, "Again." But have you ever read stories that you read a long time ago? Read them over again? Yes, absolutely. If it's a good story, it will keep giving its gifts over and over again. A good story bears reading over and over again because each time you see more in it. Bev and I are going to Ashland, Oregon. We're going to see a number of plays, all of which we know the plot for. We know exactly how it ends. And yet we will go and see them because each time you do, there's more inside of it. A good story doesn't stop giving its gifts. And that's one of the reasons why we can keep going back to those marvelous stories of the Bible. But I do insist that when you approach a biblical story or any other story, you first of all suspend your disbelief. This is something you have to do when you're watching a movie or in the theater. It's the suspended disbelief. For a little while, you suspend your disbelief that those people really on the stage are really Othello. And you know, you say, "For now, I will give that to you." That's what it is. The premises that the story makes, that three little pigs can actually build houses, or that animals can talk, or whatever it is. First of all, just grant the author or the writer those premises and read the story and get the story whole inside yourself. Then, after that, go and check the commentaries and so forth and enrich it with all of the kind of stuff that Jan is teaching this in the mornings. Enrich the story, but fall in love with it first. Enjoy it as a story first, just as is. And don't ask any questions initially about whether there were 99 sheep in the, and what happened to them and so forth. The premise there is that the shepherd had 99 sheep, he left them, they were lost, and he went looking for it. That's the opening premise. Just believe that for the first reading or two. Later on, you can ask all those other questions, but first of all, grant the premise and just go with the story, and then the story will have its gifts for you. I have another theory about what the task of us older people is. And it's a very important task. Do you know the old philosopher's question? If a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a noise? Okay. Look at the blue in those tiny petals, she squealed. It's just so lovely. And it was. At least after she showed it to us and her enthusiasm infected us, we wouldn't have seen the flower without her there to notice it for us. This was a tour group out of Valdez, Alaska. Tied to Tundra, it was called, and two young women took a dozen tourists trundling in a school bus up the mountainside through Keystone Pass and up above the tree line. One of the women called the tundra my backyard and bounced up a hillside to bring back a small bouquet of wildflowers. She knew their names, she knew their attributes, and she very clearly loved them. And for that moment, she helped us love them too. The philosopher's question. The flower with the tiny blue petals. Was it beautiful before our tour guide noticed it? Up on that windswept tundra, clods like me would walk right over such an insignificant flower. We'd step on it and kill it. But she saw it and pronounced it beautiful, and thus, I think, completed God's creation. In the old creation legend in the Bible, God creates everything, everything that is, and then says, "Behold, it is very good." But not until young women notice small flowers and marvel at their beauty is God's creation fulfilled. Beauty exists only in the eye of the beholder. God made this universe, but only God's creatures can make it beautiful. I sit across the table from my friend Jim Taylor. I'm reflecting on the story of the flower and the other beauty that Bev and I have seen on our just completed trip to Alaska. It's my job as your friend, I say to Jim, to make you beautiful. Well, now that's quite a stretch. Which is true. Neither Jim nor I have been asked to pose with or without clothes for any magazines lately, or ever for that matter. We may have some redeeming qualities which we managed to sublimate quite well, but it's been a while since anyone described either one of us as beautiful. But still, it is our job as friends to make each other beautiful. Who but friends could see the behind the grizzled exterior of two geriatric curmudgeons? Who but longtime friends can know the gentleness behind the gruffness? There is nothing objective, rational, or analytical about such seeing, any more than my appreciation of that little blue flower was objective, rational, or analytical. God created our world. That includes our friends, our family, tiny blue flowers, tour group leaders, aging friends. Our job is to recognize their beauty, to love it, and whenever possible, proclaim it. Our job as seniors is to proclaim the beauty in each other and all the beauty we see around us.
Sure, you're not beautiful, you're handsome.
I am beautiful.